Part four. We started a series several weeks ago in which we've been discussing how things got to be the way they are in the Middle East. Every week there's more news coming out of that part of the world, more danger, more hostility, more of a threat of things that could erupt at any time that would be very tragic, really, and what the impact it would have on not just the Middle East, but on the world in general. People have struggled for as long as I can remember, and long before that, trying to find a way to peace. In fact, there was a plan, I think it goes back all the way to one of the President Bush's, I think the H.W. Bush, he called it the pathway to peace, or the path to peace. And Bill Clinton had his plan for peace. And it seems like every president has had an idea for how to solve the problem, but it never gets done. And it's only going to get worse, as far as we know, from what we can see from not just history and the present, but also based on prophecy. So we've been talking in this series of sermons about the origins of the Middle East crisis. We got last time in the series to the point where Israel came into their promised land. We're going to basically pick it up from there and continue. The title of today, the sermon this morning, is Israel Evicted from the Promised Land. I have three reasons for giving this series, or three points I want to emphasize as we continue. One of them is to establish the origin of the people of the Middle East, because knowing who they are and how they got to be there explains much of the reason for the hostilities that continue in the region today. The Bible shows us, as we saw in Genesis chapter 10, that the Canaanites are descendants of Ham, and these were the very first inhabitants, or the very first to populate the land that became known as Canaan. It was named after them as they moved into the region. We read in Genesis chapter 12, verse 5, that when Abram was sent into that area, it was already inhabited by, it was the land of the Canaanites. So when Abram first went into the land, it was already Canaan's land. We also discussed, and we'll probably touch on it again, that Abraham had many sons. We think of Isaac, and once in a while we remember Ishmael, but Abraham had probably, well, I don't know, I'm going to say at least six other sons, and perhaps more than that. If you look at Genesis chapter 25, and we'll just look here quickly, we know, again, Ishmael, we know Isaac. In Genesis 25, we find that after Sarah died, Abraham remarried someone named Keturah, and she gave him six more sons. Genesis 25, verses 1 and 2, and down through verse 4. Six sons. One of them, by the way, was named Midian, and the ancestor of what we call, who the ones call the Midianites. And they turn out to be another group of people that are another family group that is hostile toward the Israelites. At any rate, six more sons by Keturah. And then verse 5 says Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac, but he gave gifts to the sons of the concubines that he had. Now, he had a wife named Sarah, a wife named Keturah, a wife named Hagar, but apparently he had concubines besides that. And maybe more sons. Well, it says he had more sons by those concubines. So Abraham had a really big family, but only one was the son of promise. God's promises to Abraham went only through his son Isaac. The promises did not go to Ishmael, did not go to any of the other sons who were actually sent away, so they would not be part of the inheritance in any sense. Then Isaac had two sons, but again, the promises that were only extended through one, through Jacob. And Esau did not receive any of the promises that God had made to Abraham. And from Jacob, we have him then with 12 sons who ultimately became the nation of Israel. And it was to them that those promises were again eventually given or fulfilled. So we see that a lot of people in the Middle East, and most of them came from Abraham. from his sons, and others of them came from descendants of Ham, which would include the Canaanites and the Philistines, who had also come to inhabit the area. Second point I want to emphasize as we go through this series is to show that Canaan was given to the descendants of Abraham as promised. We find when God led Israel into their promised land, he emphasized that he was giving them this land because it came to them through their father Abraham. Even though the Canaanites were already there, the land was promised to the Israelites. So that is the origin of the hostilities themselves, the struggle for the land, the fights between the different peoples in the land. The hostilities in the region go clear back to 1403 BC, when Israel first began to move in and to conquer the land of Canaan. People who try now, politicians and others who try to resolve the problems, have no idea where it even started. At least they don't acknowledge the historical evidence that we have of how those hostilities began to develop. And a third point that I want to emphasize, and we'll get to it today, is that the descendants of Abraham lost that land. They lost that land because they rejected God and followed pagan gods. Now, God did not go back on his promises to Abraham. The covenant is still fulfilled, but the people of Israel who inherited the land of Canaan lost the land of Canaan. They were evicted from it. We got to the point last time to the book of Judges, the book of Joshua, which gives highlights of Israel conquering Canaan. Again, they entered that land in the spring of the year 1403 BC, after having wandered, 1408 BC, after having wandered through the wilderness for 40 years. Okay, I'm going to correct myself. See, this is where I know things get confusing. I don't want to make it worse. It was 1403 when they entered the land. They left Egypt in 1443 BC, and they entered the land for the second time, and this time they conquered it in 1403 BC in the spring of that year. You remember in the early chapters of Joshua that they first entered, and the first city to fall to Israel was Jericho. Jericho, almost ironically, is one of those heavily defended, walled cities that 40 years before had frightened Israel away. It looked too strong, too fortified for them to be able to conquer. This time, as they came into the land, God showed them, and he did intervene for them, and they were willing to move to go ahead and to follow his directions, and the city fell to them, which began then the series of events that led to Israel fully conquering the land. Let's look at Joshua chapter 10. There's a summary statement here. We're going to try to cover, about 900 years of history in the next 45 minutes, so hang on. Chapter 10, verse 40. Previously, you're reading specific incidents and cities that they were conquering. Verse 40 says, Joshua conquered all the land. And it describes basically the southern part of the country that became known as Israel. It says, he left nothing remaining, but utterly destroyed all that breathed, as the Lord God had commanded. The people were, at this point, Israel was completely destroying the Canaanites, which is exactly what God had told them to do. You can go back to Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 16, where God instructs Israel to destroy every living thing as they moved into the land, and was for their own protection, so there would be no remaining part of the Canaanite culture or religion that would tempt the Israelites. Chapter 11 in Joshua, verse 16, again says that Joshua took all of the land, and it describes again some of the specific locations. He made war, it says in verse 18, a long time with all those kings. There was not a city, verse 19, that made peace with Israel, because God, it says in verse 20, hardened their hearts so that they would come out against Israel so that God could destroy them or defeat them. God's plan was for Israel to fully occupy all of the land of Canaan and for there not to be any Canaanites left to trouble them. And initially, the people of Israel were following the instruction that God had given them. In chapter 12 in Joshua, beginning in verse 1, there's a list of the Canaanite cities that Israel conquered on the east side of the Jordan River. Israel approached Canaan on this occasion, the time when they actually came into the land, from kind of the east central portion of the region. Before they were down in the southern, when they first went there, you see back in Numbers 13. But now they're in this kind of the east central area, and they crossed over into Canaan by going over the Jordan River. Before they crossed that river, they had to defeat several of the tribes and several of the cities that were on the east side of the river. And chapter 12, verses 1 through 6, describes those cities that were defeated. And then in verse 7 of this chapter, it's the beginning of a list of the kings in Canaan whose cities the Israelites conquered under Joshua's leadership. Though on the west side of the Jordan River, which is where the majority of the land of Canaan or Israel is located. They crossed the Jordan and they began defeating or confronting these other kings. It lists them. And then at the bottom of the list, verse 24, it says, all of these kings were destroyed, 31. There were 31 kings with their walled cities that were defeated. Now, a king in this sense was more of a tribal leader. It wasn't necessarily like, you know, the king of some major national group. But there were 31, and they were warriors, they were protecting their property, their land, they lived in cities that were walled and not easy to conquer. But Joshua, with God leading him and blessing his people, was able then to destroy these 31 kings and their cities. But there were still pockets of Canaanite tribes throughout the land. Chapter 13 says that when Joshua was old, God said to him, you are old and advanced in years, and there remains very much land yet to be possessed. So they were making enough progress, and as you continue, you see that at this point, even though there was still a great deal of work to be done to rid the land of all of the Canaanites, God told them to go ahead and divide the land between the tribes. And then each tribe would be responsible for dealing with the Canaanites that were still left in their location. But he promises in chapter 13, verse 6, that I will drive them out from before the children of Israel. But he says, divide by lot to Israel their inheritance. And so each tribe was assigned a portion of the land, and they would be responsible for dealing with the Canaanites that remained in that land. As Israel divided the land and moved in this way, this is kind of, to me, the transition point where the land of Canaan became the nation of Israel. The nation of Israel was established as the people were assigned their locations and they moved into them. Notice a little bit of a hint, though, of a problem already in chapter 13, verse 13. It says, Joshua 13, verse 13, nevertheless, the children of Israel did not drive out the Geshurites or the Maacites. They dwelt among the Israelites, or they do continue to until this day. These were tribes that were on the east side of the Jordan. These were tribes that were initially encountered, but they were not fully driven away. And so While it was generally true that at this point they were conquering the cities and killing all of those, everything that was alive in those cities, there were some soft spots, some areas where the job had not really been completed in its entirety. Move ahead to chapter 23 in Joshua. Joshua 23. What's important here, and I emphasized this last week, is that the people of Israel are displacing the Canaanites and those who live in the land. It was not an easy job. These people had been living in this territory for hundreds of years. They had family history, they had culture, that was their home. And the Israelites were coming to drive them away. And with God's direction and strength and help, they were being successful. It came to pass, chapter 23, verse 1, a long time after the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their enemies, that Joshua was old. So as they moved in and settled in, God gave them peace. God gave them rest from their battles. They began to settle in the land. Joshua is old. He died at the age of 110. And we see here that he's going to give a final address, so to speak, to the people. Verse 4, I've divided to you by lot these nations that remain to be an inheritance to your tribes. Verse 5, and the Lord your God will expel them from before you and drive them out of your sight, and you shall possess the land. Therefore, verse 6, be very courageous to keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses. And dropping down to verse 8, he says, hold fast to the Lord your God as you have done to this day. Because if you don't, there will be serious consequences, is what he goes on to tell them. The Lord has driven out these nations from before you, verse 9. He'll make you strong, verse 10. One man of you will chase 1,000 of them, for the Lord your God is he who fights for you. Therefore, verse 11, very important point that Joshua makes to the children of Israel at this time. Therefore, take careful heed to yourselves that you love the Lord your God. You know, we can find personal lessons all the way through this kind of a story, but I think it kind of hits home to us a bit to read a statement like that, that it's important to make a special effort to be sure that we recognize and honor God for what he does in our lives. Be sure. Take heed. Careful heed. Remember to love your God and not take for granted, for Israel's sake or for our sake, those things that God has done for us. Verse 12, warning to Israel, it says, if indeed you go back and cling to the remnant of these nations, those that remain among you, and make marriages with them and go into them and they to you, then know this for certain, God will no longer drive them out from before you, but they will become snares and traps and scourges. Pretty strong warning to the people of Israel to do what they were told to do, to destroy the Canaanites and to remember to take special care to love their God. Chapter 24 begins, this is a continuation of the address or the final comments of Joshua to the people. He gathered them together again, chapter 24. And in the initial verses here in this chapter, he summarizes how God rescued Israel from Egypt and drove the Canaanites out so they could inherit the land. I find it interesting that over and over throughout Israel's experience, the message goes back to this very point. Remember that God brought you out of Egypt. If the generations that followed would have remembered that and remembered who God was and what all he had done for them, then they may not have made nearly the kind of mistakes that they made that led to their disastrous end. Remember what happened in Egypt and how God intervened, the miracles of God that he performed on your behalf. This is not the generation that left Egypt that he's writing, that he's speaking to here. The generation that left Egypt that had these direct experiences died in the wilderness. This is another generation. But he's speaking to them as if it had happened to them, to remember what God had done. Verses 14 and 15, he concludes this part by saying, look, therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. He's referring back to those before Abraham's time and those who lived in Egypt as slaves, that they had gotten wrapped up in other forms of worship. He says, serve the Lord, serve Yahweh. And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, well, choose for yourself. You make your choice. He said, I urge you to obey and to worship and to honor the God of Abraham, the God who brought us out of Egypt. But it's your choice. You decide what you want to do. Then the famous statement, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Very moving statement or passed a message that he gave to them, and the people responded to it. It says in verse 17 that we will serve the Lord, for he is our God. Joshua warned them in the next couple of verses that they were not likely to be able to do that. The chances are they would not be able to continue as they had said that they wanted to. But the people again stated that they wanted, verse 23, no, but we will serve the Lord. So Joshua said, okay, then you're a witness against yourself. Those words are, you said those words, so now you've got to live up to them. And they answered, says, yes, we're witnesses. Then verse 23 again is interesting. He says, Joshua told them, now therefore, put away the foreign gods which are among you. They were already, or maybe I should say still, involved in idolatry. They're making a commitment to Yahweh, to their God, to the God of Israel, but they were already or still had with them their own pagan foreign gods. That Joshua said, okay, if you're making this commitment, then get rid of the pagan gods. Put them out. So they said that they would do that. They wanted, and I think they had, it was a sincere commitment that they made. And yet we know that it was not one that they were able to continue. Judges chapter 2, we'll skip ahead and we'll see what happens after Joshua died. Joshua chapter 2, verse 7, it says, the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, those who had seen all the great works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. And then, verse 10, when that generation had been gathered to their fathers, or they had died, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord, nor the work which he had done for Israel. Then the children of Israel did evil and served the Baals and forsook the Lord God of their fathers. Something occurred here that, again, I think highlights something that we can learn. I'm going to call it generational drift. The generation that came after they had conquered the land did not have the same experience, the same memory, and therefore the same relationship or faith in God of those who came before them. I think, again, that highlights a lesson, you know, once more, that we can learn. We must be careful to avoid generational drift. Those who came along at this, who lived in this time, had not been through the same experiences. They were not the generation that came through the wilderness. They were not the generation who died in the wilderness, came out of Egypt. They're not the generation who died in the wilderness. They were not even the generation that fought for the land of Canaan. These were the ones who came along later, It's about, depending on where you want to start counting, the third or fourth generation out of Egypt. They didn't have the same experience as those before them. Again, a reason why they did not maintain that commitment to God is most likely because they failed to, it was not taught to them the way that it should be. Judges chapter 3, verse 1. These are the nations which the Lord left, that he might test Israel by them. They'd made their choice. They'd conquered the land mostly. There were still some pockets of Canaanites that had not been dealt with. They'd committed themselves. They were going to follow their God, and they would serve him. So God gave them a test. And he did so through the people that remained in the land, that he might test Israel by them, that is, all who had not known any of the wars in Canaan. This was only so that they might, that the generations of the children of Israel might be taught to know war, at least those who had not formerly known it. So these were the ones who grew up in Canaan as their land, after it had been fought for and won. And they were not part of that struggle. And they didn't have the same connection to God. Very important, as we have emphasized in the church, to pass along to the younger members in our church the same commitment that we have learned through our experiences. Have you ever said to your kids, when I was your age, or try to explain to them what it was like for you as compared to the life that they have? I tried that a few times. It never went well. It never really worked. I was never really able to express why I felt they should learn certain lessons because of what I had done, what I had learned. But we do want those who come after us to recognize and realize and to learn the same kinds of lessons we learned. But you know, anyone in the church today who is under the age of 40 has no recollection of Herbert Armstrong. When we talk about Mr. Armstrong, then he is an historical figure in their lives. Anyone under the age of about 30 has little or no recollection of the church's struggles in the early 1990s and the changes that took place that pretty much made us the way we are today in terms of our numbers and the way the church is configured. They didn't have that experience. Now, they can learn from it. I think that they are. We can pass that along to them. But I think it's a special challenge for those who didn't have those same experiences to have the same commitment for truth in the sense that those who went through it. You fought a war if you came through 1992, 1993, 1994. And that was a spiritual war that you had to fight. Those who came later can still have a depth of commitment, but they don't learn it in the same way. And so to avoid generational drift, we certainly want to emphasize and to help those who are coming after us to understand the lessons that we have learned. In Israel, it didn't happen. And this generation came along who hadn't participated in any of these struggles to establish the land. And God was testing them, verse 4, that he might test Israel to know whether they would obey the commandments of the Lord. And we know what happened. A few years after Joshua died, they quickly faded away. Back up in chapter 2, we find a description of a cycle that started after Joshua had died. Verse 10, we read this already, that the generation arose that did not know the Lord, nor the work that he had done. And then they began to do evil, and they forsook God and their fathers. This is the history of Israel that we're talking about in their land of promise. They bowed down to the other gods, verse 12. Verse 13, they forsook the Lord, and they served Baal and the Ashereths. Mentioned before, this was just a, 60 or so years after they had come into the land, they already were turning away from and forsaking their commitment to God, the commitment they had made so strongly that this he was their God, they would obey him. They forsook the Lord and they served Baal. And then it says at the end of verse 7 that he delivered them into the hands of plunderers who despoiled them. And he sold them into the hands of their enemies so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them for calamity, as the Lord had said and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were greatly distressed. So God immediately began to punish the nation for their abandoning of him because they had gone to worship other gods and their life became very difficult. Nevertheless, verse 16, the Lord raised up judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who had plundered them. Yet they did not listen to their judges, and they played the harlot with other gods and bowed down to them. They turned quickly away from the way in which their fathers walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord. And when the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord who was with those judges and delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of that judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who had oppressed them and harassed them. And it came to pass when the judge was dead that they reverted and behaved more corruptly than their fathers by following other gods. So there's the cycle. They were punished. God would raise up a judge who would bring them, who lead them in a right way, bring them to repentance. They would get their lives together as long as that judge was alive. But as soon as he was gone, they reverted back to the way they had gotten in trouble in the first place. So they went through this cycle over and over and over again for the next 300 years. The book of Judges covers roughly 309 years from the time of the death of Joshua to the end of the book of Judges. Until we come to the end of the book of Judges, a statement again that you very likely are familiar with, the last sentence in the book of Judges, chapter 21, verse 25. Judges 21, verse 25. In those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. What a way for the people of Israel to end up. These are the descendants of Abraham, the inheritors of his promise, the land that flowed with milk and honey. God was going to be their God. They were going to be prosperous and be an example for all the other nations of the world. But instead, because of their choice, they wound up in complete disarray, total chaos. Everyone just doing what he thought was right, with no structure for the nation whatsoever. Again, I think we find a personal lesson that we can draw. In 2 Corinthians chapter 6, 2 Corinthians chapter 6, Paul writes of how we live in a corrupt world. We live in a world that is distant from, separate from our God. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, we'll begin reading in verse 14. Israel, of course, was a physical nation. They were to be partitioned from the rest of the world and to be God's people. As God's church, we are called out of the world, but we still live in the world. We're not physically separated in the way that Israel was intended to be as a separate nation. But we do live apart from the society in which we live. In verse 14, Paul says, "Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness, and what communion has light with darkness? The people of Israel had no business getting involved with the Baals and the Ashereths and all the gods and the ways of the pagans. We have no part in the world around us in its systems and ways. What communion has light with darkness, and what accord has Christ with Belial, representation of Satan himself? What part has a believer with an unbeliever, and what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. That's what God has called us to be. He called that physical nation to be separate in its way, but he's called us, in a spiritual sense, to be the temple of the living God as a group, each of us individually with God's Spirit in us. As God had said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I'll be their God and they'll be my people. That was a promise made to Israel, but now we apply it as a church. Therefore, verse 17, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. I will be a father to you, and you'll be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty. So this is a battle that we fight to hold our ground, just as Israel was to fight to hold their ground in a moral sense and in a literal sense. God tested Israel by the circumstances they were facing, and we are tested as well. Now back to the story of Israel. The rest of the book of Judges gives the history of Israel for those 300 years from the time of after Joshua had died to the end of the period of the Judges. You'll find as you read through the book of Judges that the enemies of the people, same old guys, same people, the Canaanites, the Philistines, Moab, Ammon, Amalekites, descendants of Abraham, the same ones in the region continued to be those that troubled Israel. And so Israel came to the point, as we saw in chapter 21, verse 22, that there was no structure. It was a chaotic world in which they lived. Following of the book of Judges, we come, of course, to 1 Samuel. In 1 Samuel, we read of the man Samuel, who was a prophet, and he was also the last righteous judge over Israel. We read of him in chapters 1 through 8, and how the people looked to him, and God, he was a godly man. God worked in him and through him to lead the people. But the people wanted a king. These people were living in such chaos, such confusion. Judges come and judges go. They wanted the stability that the other nations around them had. They wanted to have a king. And this, frankly, was something that God had anticipated. Just make a note. You can go back to Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 14. God said, when you come into your own land, you're going to want a king. And then he described what kind of person should be a king over his people. In 1 Samuel chapter 9, Saul is chosen to be the first king over Israel. This was in 1048 B.C. 1048 B.C. is when Saul became the first king. As a point of reference, this is 395 years after the Exodus. A lot has happened in those four centuries. And the people have been given that land of promise, and they've made a real mess out of their situation. And now they want a king, so God allowed them, or God chose for them, Saul. Saul, of course, failed, and God chose David. And we're going to just do a very superficial summary of the events here that occur in Israel from this point on. In 1 Samuel 13, verse 13, we know that Saul failed. He rebelled against the specific instructions that were given to him as king. He reigned for 40 years, but it was only the first 2 years or so of that reign that God was actually working with him, and that he submitted himself to God. But in 1 Samuel 13, verse 13, Samuel said to Saul, "You've done foolishly. You've not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart." And that, of course, is David. David is described in those same words in Acts 13, verse 22. God chose one who had a heart that would yield to him and that was sincere and desired to follow God. So David was chosen to be the next king over Israel. David reigned from 1008 B.C. until 968 B.C. 1008 to 968 B.C., the reign of David. That was followed, of course, by his son Solomon. Solomon also reigned for 40 years. Each of the first three kings reigned for that period of time. Solomon was king from 968 to 928 B.C. And you find the beginning of his reign in 1 Kings chapter 2. 1 Kings chapter 2. Solomon did a lot of great things in his years as he was the king. For one thing, he asked God to give him an understanding heart or to give him wisdom. He had enough sense to realize he couldn't rule those people on his own, and so he went to God and asked for wisdom. And how is Solomon known? As the wisest man who lived. And the one who is responsible for the book of Proverbs, which has so much wisdom within it. A man of tremendous wisdom and intellect and understanding. Solomon built the temple. A temple that his father had planned. It was to be the center of worship for the people of Israel. And it continued to be for a few hundred years. Solomon was initially a righteous man as he looked to God for the strength and the help that God would provide for him. But Solomon made the same mistake that Israel did. He made the exact same mistake that the nation before him had made. 1 Kings chapter 11. 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 1. Solomon loved many foreign women. Among them, an Egyptian woman, the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Sidonians, and the Hittites. Who are these people? Well, the Moabites, the Ammonites, and the Edomites are all descendants of Abraham through the part of the family that didn't receive the promises. The ones in the lands around Israel who worshipped other gods. The Sidonians and Hittites were Canaanite tribes. These are the same people that troubled Israel. Now Solomon stumbles into the same trap with the same people. Solomon clung to these women in love. Well, maybe we give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he truly loved these women, or maybe he just loved loving women. I don't know what it was, but he has hundreds of them, 700 wives and 300 concubines, and guess what? His wives turned away his heart. His wives turned him away from God. Remember what the people of those tribes were going to be to Israel? Thorns in their eyes, and trouble to them constantly all around them. It was so when Solomon was old, verse 4, that his wives turned his heart after other gods. Not only did they seduce him in some physical way, but they turned him to actually worship other gods. His heart was not loyal to the Lord. Solomon went after Ashereth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord. Solomon fell into that same cycle or that same trap. probably is not humanly possible, even though it was something that God ideally set for them. But what if all of those tribes had been, of the Canaanites, had been totally wiped out? Well, the Ammonites and the Edomites and the Moabites still would have been there, because those are other descendants of Abraham. But at least the Canaanites could have been taken out of the picture if the people of Israel had followed what God had told them to do. Well, we know that because of Solomon's sin, his kingdom was taken away from him. The kingdom of Israel, which for 120 years under these first kings had experienced wealth and prosperity and security and safety, now was going to be divided by civil war. And the nation was divided between the son of Solomon, who was Rehoboam, and a man named Jeroboam, a general in Solomon's army, who was Ephraimite. 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 25. After he became king over the 10 tribes that were given to him to have response, as the nation was taken away from Solomon, he built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim, and he dwelt there. He was Ephraimite, and he built his palace in the land of Ephraim. And he went out from there and built other places. Jeroboam said in his heart, now here's where Jeroboam blew it himself. It says, if these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they'll kill me and go back to Rehoboam. So he was, he's afraid that the people of Israel are going to go back to Judah if they go to Jerusalem to worship God. That was the center of their tradition, their culture, their way of life. And he didn't want them, he wanted them to be completely separated from that previous way so that his kingdom, he thought, would be secure. So he asked advice. Doesn't say here who he asked advice of, but you can see from what the advice is that it wasn't a reliable source. He asked advice, and he made 2 calves of gold, and he said to the people, look, it's too much trouble to go to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt. By the sentence itself is preposterous. These could not be the gods who brought them out of Egypt. But again, we're talking about people who are pretty ignorant of their history, pretty ignorant of who God is, who have lost sight of who it was who brought them up out of Egypt. And so they were inclined to go along with it and to fall for it. And he even ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month. And we'll be going to keep the Feast of Tabernacles soon. He just moved the Feast of Tabernacles a month later. So the people who didn't have to go to Jerusalem to keep the feast, they could go to Bethel, where he had established his temple of worship. Point is that Israel turned to idols. The 10 tribes of Israel continued their idolatrous ways. As you read through the history of Israel in 1 and 2 Kings, you see that they continued this worship of pagan gods and practicing pagan customs for the next about 210 years after Jeroboam became king. Meanwhile, what's happening in Judah is very similar. Judah was initially led at the time of this division by Rehoboam, Solomon's son, and he didn't show a lot of wisdom. You know, first thing Solomon did when he became king was to ask God to grant him wisdom. Rehoboam, when he became king, wasn't so much worried about what God would do. He went to other advisors, other young men who were advisors, to see what they should do or how he should rule over the land. and he began to make some very serious mistakes from the very outset. For the next 340 years, Judah continued its kind of an up and down roller coaster type of an existence. They'd have a righteous king and then an evil king and then a righteous king and then an evil king. The nation, the kings themselves sometimes were righteous and sometimes not, but the people of the land continued to worship the false gods. They continued to worship the false gods even when there was a righteous king. So what happened? Well, you can go back to Leviticus 26. I'll just give you that as a reference. And remember that way back at the very beginning of the nation of Israel, in Leviticus was a book that was given to them just months after they had come out of Egypt. And Leviticus is essentially a book about how to be God's people. Leviticus is where you find the sacrifices introduced. You find that the holy days are introduced. You find that tithing is introduced. Leviticus was a manual how to be God's people. Remember, Peter quotes Leviticus where he says, "Be you holy, for I am holy." That's pretty much the theme of the book of Leviticus. And at the very beginning then, when this instruction was given to them, is recorded in the book of Leviticus, chapter 26 records the blessings that will come if they obey him and the destructive curses that will come if they do not. So what came about eventually in Israel and in Judah was the fulfillment of those warnings. The punishment of Israel began. They began to lose the land that God had given to them through Abraham. 2 Kings 17. Verse 5. 2 Kings 17, verse 5. The king of Assyria went throughout the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it for 3 years. The nation of Judah is referred to as Judah, and they lived in the area where the Jews had basically inhabited Israel before the division. Samaria was in the northern part of the nation, and this is basically the capital area of the northern kingdom of Israel. And so Assyria, the king of Assyria, attacks Samaria and besieged it for 3 years. These were the years 721 through 718 BC, when Assyria attacked and eventually defeated, during that 3-year period of time, the nation of Israel. And it says in verse 6, in the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria, the ninth year of Hoshea, he's the king of Israel, in his ninth year, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria. This is 682 years after they had come into the land of milk and honey, the land of promise, their inheritance as the chosen descendants of Abraham. The nation of Israel was dragged out of their promised land and taken into captivity. We'll just note in passing that in verse 24 through the end of the chapter, the king of Assyria brought into Samaria, where the Israelites had been taken from, he brought in other peoples from other lands. And they developed a hybrid religion which combined the worship of pagan gods with some of the rituals of the people of Israel, of worshiping the true God. And so this land of Samaria became a place where there's this mix of people. Some of them, there were still a few Israelites who remained after most were taken away. Mostly these foreign people who were brought in, who developed their own, they combined worshiping their God with trying to worship Yahweh, the God of Israel. This is the origin of the people that are despised by the Jews in Jesus' time, the Samaritans. This is where the Samaritans began during this time when they were brought in to live in the land that Israel had been taken from. Now, very quickly, 2 Chronicles chapter 36 tells a similar story. 2 Chronicles 36 tells the fall of Judah. This took place over a period of about 20 years, beginning in the year 606 BC. The king of Babylon invaded the city of Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar, it says in verse 6 of 2 Chronicles 36, came to Babylon against him, that is against the king of Judah, who at that time was Jehoiakim, and bound him and carried him off to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar also carried off some of the articles from the house of the Lord to Babylon and put them in his temple. This was the first invasion of Judah by Babylon. And at this time, Judah began to be destroyed. Then the final invasion is described beginning in verse 17. The king of the Chaldeans killed their young men with the sword. Verse 18, the articles from the house of God, great and small, and all the treasures were taken to Babylon. They burned the house of God and broke down the wall of Jerusalem. The temple that Solomon had built was destroyed in this final siege of Jerusalem. And the people of Judah were carried away into captivity in Babylon. This is now 816 years after they had entered the land of promise. Judah and Israel are both now evicted from the land of their promise. Now, again, God did not abandon his promise to Abraham. He fulfilled that covenant. And I'm going to have to let you read of that in the church's booklet, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, which details how the promises to Abraham continued to be fulfilled even after this time. But the land was taken from them. So let's quickly summarize a couple of more points to conclude. They were carried away in 587 or so, 586 B.C., in 536 B.C., which is 70 years after the first group was taken from Jerusalem, after the first invasion, 536 B.C., a remnant of the nation of Judah returned to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. In chapter 36, verse 21, hauling the people away to captivity, we read here, we pick it up in verse 21, this was done to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land enjoyed her Sabbaths. As long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. The captivity of Judah, which began in 536, continued for 70 years. Then it says in verse 22, the king of Cyrus, king of Persia, received the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, and he gives a proclamation. Cyrus, now something major has happened here in the meantime. Cyrus, the king of Persia, has defeated the king of Babylon, and now Cyrus is in control of this region, and he releases the Jews from their captivity in Babylon. And so 70 years after the original temple was destroyed, In 516 BC, the Jews completed their work on a new temple, a replacement for the one that had been destroyed. This has some significance for us, and we'll conclude with that thought. This temple was rebuilt, and this is the temple that was standing during the time of Jesus Christ. Turn to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24. Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. This is the same temple which had been completed in the days of Zechariah and Haggai and Ezra. This is the same temple that was built to replace the one that had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. In the years before Jesus Christ was born, Herod, the king of the king over the region in Jerusalem, had added to the temple. It had undergone a really major renovation. And while the temple that was originally built to replace the first temple was one that the people were not, those who could remember the first temple looked at the new one and said, well, this is not anything near as wonderful and as beautiful as what we had before. But Herod, in the years just before Jesus was born, had expanded the temple into a very impressive complex of buildings. And the disciples, being Jewish, took some pride in what the temple had become. They knew its history. They knew about its destruction and its rebuilding. And now, here it is, some 500 or so years after the temple had been rebuilt. And it's a very impressive, major building in Jerusalem. And they were proud of it as they showed it to Jesus. And he said to them, verse 2, do you not see all these things? Look at these buildings. Look at this temple. Assuredly, he says, I say to you that not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down. So they kind of took the wind out of their sails. They were so proud of their temple. But he said, you know what? This is going to be completely destroyed. Not one stone will be left upon another. Many people feel that this prophecy was fulfilled in the year 70 by a Roman soldier named Titus, who razed the city of Jerusalem and destroyed the temple once again. This temple that they were so proud of was destroyed by Titus's army in the year 70. But one of the walls still remains. There's a wall of that temple standing in Jerusalem. The Jews call it the Wailing Wall because they go there to bemoan their history and to cry out to God for his intervention for them as a people. The prophecy Jesus gave here was not fulfilled by Titus when the city and the temple were destroyed 50 or so years after Jesus spoke these words. And there's also another major event that's going to take place that will originate at that very location. And this event at the place of the temple will trigger the events of the end of the age. Verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place. The holy place is the place of the altar. It's where the sacrifices were made. A very precise location. Israel was told to build on this site, and this is the only place sanctioned by God, that sacrifices to him were to be made. Something is going to happen on that very location in the future, maybe the near future. When that happens, verse 16 continues on down to about verse 26, everything's going to break loose. When that event takes place at that temple, the most incredibly significant event is going to take place there at that very site. Much is yet to happen in the Middle East and in Jerusalem in particular. We've tried, and I think it was very, very superficial, but we've tried to review the history from Abraham up through the time of Israel and Judah in their land of promise, and glanced ahead to the time when Jesus and the disciples were at the temple, and Jesus prophesied a major event that will still occur at that location. Much has happened in the Middle East. So much has happened in the Middle East. So many people, such a confusing area and place of hostility and friction and war. And we see the origins of it by looking at the history that we've reviewed so briefly. But much is still going to happen. And the events that will take place there will lead to the return of Jesus Christ. So we'll review those events, hopefully next Sabbath, in what should be the final part of this series.